Hey, good morning, y'all. Bear with me one moment. I need to do something. I'll be right back with you. I think you can hear the music. Listen to the music. I'll be back. Good morning. My name is behavior scientist Tenola Oliver, and thank you for joining me of this edition of the Making of the Mogul radio show, where the dream is free, but the hustle is so separately. So we have a few topics together up today and to unpack. Primarily because I haven't been on here in several weeks. And I think I had told you all that I would be pulling back for a while. I wonder what's I supposed to... Anyhow, let me focus. All right. I was trying to do a little bit of multitasking there. So yeah, I told you all that the recordings for the show would probably decrease for a little while. I have a lot of different projects that I'm working on, but I miss you all. I miss my audience. I miss your feedback, and miss you all telling me, you know, how you feel about the show and things of that nature. So let's talk this morning, okay? Give me one moment. I need to raise my mic up. Alrighty, so this is, if you subscribe to the Making of the Mogul radio show and magazine, I wrote an article this morning about raising African-American children while living public lives. And so that means a lot of different things for a lot of different people, whether you're a politician, whether your people see you or perceive you as a public figure, whether you're a celebrity, whether you're a very notable person in the community, any African-American person that raises or children while living a life in the public spotlight, it is an animal of a different species. And today I wanted to just kind of do a brain dump and talk about it. So I wrote an article about it. And then I did like an introduction to the article on Facebook. And what was my motivation for it was because I still keep seeing a lot of commentary from the general public about T.I.'s relationship with his son. And I try to stay out of hot topics as it relates to when it focuses on specific people, right?
Because I believe that anytime we have to stop living our lives to have a conversation about somebody else's life, that's not the divinity of God, right? Because we all have enough things that are taking place in our own lives that if we don't have the ability to add some positive value to other people's lives, then we just need to sit it out, right? And it is difficult to raise children while living a life in the spotlight. And King is trying to work through a lot as an adolescent. And I always try to remind my audience that the adolescent brain is not fully developed until the age of 25. To really be able to make independent decisions, inferring and deferring information without pulling information from the environment that you're in. Because sometimes the environment that you're in can be deceptive or it can be toxic, right? So for the average adolescent, I'm talking about non-Black adolescent, the brain is not fully developed until the age of 25. Now, if you're an African American and you've had to deal with parents who have had to overcome trauma, or if you have had to deal with the various toxic structures of organizational racism, right? Or any poverty, any form of oppression or suppression, any of that affects that developmental process. And it pushes that age from 25 to 30. And I think it's important for us to understand that as people in the community. And that's all I'm gonna say about that. If you like to read the article, you can subscribe to the Making of the Mogul magazine. It's $7 per month. You have the ability to get parts of interviews and talks that I don't release to the public, right? So I do release regular commentary weekly for subscribers, and then I try to do public tapings such as this one at least every 2 months or every 3 months just for the public, right? It's Sunday. And just in the spirit of encouragement, I want to remind people that we serve a Lord who is omnipresent and omniscient, all-knowing and all-encompassing. And so what does that mean for us is that I preached, I'm going to have to find that sermon so I can repost the sermon. When I was pastoring, I preached a sermon on God redeems. And within it, I say God redeems people, he redeems places, he redeems time, and he redeems words, right? And we can associate the redemption of words with reputation. We can define the redemption of words as in removing the toxicity that the enemy tries to attach to words, right? However we want to define it, my purpose today is to reassure you and to remind you that you serve a Lord that redeems, right? that he is the ultimate force in the earth, right? That the Lord is King of Kings. The Lord reigns supreme. The Lord has all power in his hands. And I want you to remember today that whatever the Lord has to do to get you from where you are to where you ought to be, whatever he has to redeem in the middle, whether that's relationships, whether he has to redeem the time for you, if he has to redeem your youth, if he has to redeem whatever it is that the Lord holds all power in his hands to do it. And it's not a matter of if he's able, is that he is able and that he shall, because it is his good pleasure. That's what the word says. It is his good pleasure to give you the desires of your heart and to prosper you and for you to live an abundant and blessed life. That is God's desire. That's what the word says. It says that all of his promises are yea and amen. It doesn't matter what anybody else don't want you to have, right? It doesn't matter what anybody else tried to do or tried to block you from. The Lord has the ability in order to get you from where you are to where you should be to redeem everything in between. And how he does it is his business, right? It's the Lord's business. We just have to remember that the Lord is not only able, but that he shall. Like some people get stuck on the part that he's able, but they don't remember that he shall. The word also says that he shall. He shall do it, right? It is his good pleasure to give you the desires of your heart, right? As long as it doesn't contradict all of the other stuff in the Bible. Like some people, what they want is in contradiction to what the word says, and then they don't understand why various events begin to unfold in their lives, right? But the reason that they unfold is because they desired things that was not in line biblically with who the Lord says that he is. But his grace is sufficient. His grace is sufficient. And so even when we are out of the will of the Lord, it is still his good pleasure to redeem you and to show you grace and to bring you back to the place where you're supposed to be. And I just want to remind you, I feel like somebody needs to hear that today. That feels like their path may be off the path, the beaten path of the terrain that they felt that the Lord was had positioned them for. And from the point from where you are to where you ought to be, the Lord will redeem everything in between. And not in a toxic way. That's how you know who is sent of God and who is not sent of God. It's because the Lord doesn't have to do anything toxic to redeem you. He doesn't have to do anything to harm you or to damage your psyche to redeem you and bring you back to a place of wholeness. It is his good pleasure to see you whole and to see you healthy. And he is not a God that is a God of fear, right? So anything that tries to speak to you through fear is not of God, right? He is a God of sound mind and love, right? And so it is his love and his protection that keeps you out of the hands of the enemy. And you just have to trust and believe that while he's redeeming you, that he is an ambidextrous God, right? I preached a sermon on that before too. That he is an ambidextrous God. And so he is not without tactic or without strategy. And while he's redeeming you, he's also fighting that what is fighting you. The Bible says he'll contend with that contends against you. And he'll fight against that fight against you. I tell you what, that Bible was something, baby. And I'm not talking from a point of seeing something that happened in somebody else's life. I'm talking from experience. I'm gonna have to let that rest right there, because I was fitting to shout. I almost shouted. I was about to shout. And so let's move on. And so today, there's a lot that I just want to bring some redress to. And so I already opened up with being Black and raising children in the spotlight. I did post the article on, the introduction to the article that I wrote, which is a much larger article that has some research points and some reference points for you to go back and read some of the material that I read when I'm gathering information and doing various research, particularly as it relates to the development of the adolescent brain and why we shouldn't allow our children, if possible, not to make any major, major decisions before the age of 30. And I'm not talking about not dating like you date, right? I'm talking about, I'm not saying forbidding your children to have children. If they're married, right, then yes, have children, right? I'm talking about some of those other major decisions that can prove to be anti-humanity and that can potentially be toxic for later seasons of a young person's life, and because they don't really have the ability to make those decisions with clarity before the age of 30, then sometimes they just remain fragmented to the mistakes that they've made, because now they don't feel like they can turn it around, or now they feel like that's how they, that's who they are, right? And that they don't have the ability to make any adjustments. And that's unequivocally not true, right? And we have to remind young people, right? That, and I tell young people all the time, anything that you've done before the age of 18, people have to take it with a grain of salt, because a lot of what you do before the age of 18 is under the auspice and the influence of an adult that was in your life. And you still have an opportunity to get it right, right? You still have an opportunity to get it right. But the problem is that because we're so far from the design, the natural design of who Elohim is, right? Is that, we don't know what it means to repent. And so we make mistakes young, before the age of 18, and then we have people in our lives that don't teach us that repentance is a real thing. And there's some things that we do have to go back and get it right. And because the people that are in our lives, we don't see that mirrored, and we don't see that level of maturity in their life. And so we don't know how to demonstrate in that in our own lives, because there's nobody that that really operates in that maturity. Right. And so please reassure your children that before the age of 30, still that they are very much still working things out within their psyche and their mentality. I need to plug up my laptop. One moment, please. Alrighty, thank you so much. Bear with me one moment. Okay, I have that plugged up. And so, in saying that, the good thing about adults that are past the age of 30 who have a circle of individuals who accountability that have people who hold them to accountability. I think it is so dangerous when we go through life without any sort of accountability. The people that'll make you do right by your spouse, right? The people that'll make you get it right with your children or with someone that you've offended, or when people know that you've done wrong, right? By one of your children, the people that, not the toxic voices, but the people that are more mature than you, and they come back and tell you, you didn't handle that right. Like, it is so dangerous to live our lives with just people, yes, people around us, and people who all see on the same level and all think on the same immature level. That's dangerous, because you miss the opportunity to repent and get some things right. And so the unfortunate thing, I have people in my life that that have decided that they are going to be in agreement with things that they know was wrong, because they don't have the humility and the accountability to get it right. And that's okay. That's okay. But I've seen what it looks like when people carry that all of their lives, right? I've seen how it ages people, and I see how it affects people's health. I told somebody the other day, my grandmother lived to be 98 years old. And I know it was because she kept clean hands and a pure heart. And I'm not saying she was perfect throughout her entire life, but I'm saying that when she did decide to get it right and to get it together, she got it right and got it together so that she could live a long and prosperous life. And she spent the majority of her life, even in her elderly years, taking care of people. That is what helped her to thrive. And I think that was the spirit of what kept her spirit rejuvenated and energized and feeling relevant in the land of the living, right? When you do good by people, good finds you. And I cannot say that enough. But you should subscribe to the Making of the Mogul Radio Show and magazine so that you can read that article on parenting and the development of the adolescent brain. And so, yes, I remember interviewing T.I.'s son. And if you have an opportunity, go to the Facebook page. I think I put it on the ELA Foundation page. And I remember the moments in our interview that felt real. So because for me, this is not just about popularity and it's not just about followers, but it is part of the ministry that I do, right? I can remember T.I.'s son getting kind of emotional when we talked about his mom. And I didn't talk about his parents from a perspective of their celebrityism. I talked about his parents from a humanity perspective and how he seen himself in relation to his parents' success and not feeling the pressure to have to live up to their brand or to the level of success that they have obtained, but knowing that being more than who they were was definitely within his reach. And I remember, I think I mentioned his mom twice. And the first time I wasn't really sure if he was getting emotional or if he was just thinking or whatever. But the next time I mentioned him, I definitely mentioned his mom. I definitely could feel the shift in his emotions. So I shifted the conversation from that. But that relationship between a mother and a son, that's a special type of something. And T.I. is going to have to find ways to make amends with, and I'm trying to think, is that his youngest son? No, that's not his youngest son. I think that might be his middle son. Whatever and however King feels about his father and some things that he's seen between his father and his mother. And it's funny how you can have more than one child, you can have several children being raised in the same household and they can all have different experiences. And obviously King has had a different experience with his parents, particularly with his father. And I hope they work that dynamic out, because not every parent child works that dynamic out. And it's unfortunate, particularly when the parent doesn't have the maturity to repent and to get it right and to stop trying to save face. Right. And so I hope they work that dynamic out. But if you've never had to raise children while living a life in the public, you got to sit this one out on the parenting advice, because it's a totally different dynamic. It's a totally different dynamic. And the attention seeking that King is doing is predictable. It is absolutely predictable. And he's going to have a time between now and the age of 25 and 30 and working whatever he needs to heal from. And I hope that as the public, the reason I wrote the article on Facebook today is I hope that the public allows him the grace and the space without continuing to press their toxicity on the top of what it already looks like a volatile situation, so that a father and a son can heal their relationship without all of the pressure of people on the outside looking in. And while I understand people are like, oh, but when you choose to live a public life, then your life is going to be public. That don't have nothing to do with the innocence of childhood. Nothing. And we all, most of us are parents, whether natural parents, bonus parents, spiritual parents, some sort of parenting, right? And if you have any ounce of decency, right, you would allow that young man the space and the time to be able to heal from the things that he needs to be able to heal from. And it don't matter what it is. It ain't none of our business, whatever it is. He deserves the space to heal from it. And so let's move on. So that's that. We have 8 topics today. That's the first 3, raising Black children while living a life in the spotlight. And that doesn't necessarily just mean celebrities. There are a lot of different other personalities and careers and functions that you can be in that can shine a light on you, right? And make the experience for your children a little bit different. Raising children now versus the next version of you, right? That's for anybody, right? And sometimes that's part of the dynamic in parenting. The old version of you versus the version of who you are while you're raising that child. And that's in that article. I talk more about that in the article that I wrote on the development of the adolescent brain, and then raising Black children while living a life in the spotlight. And then we talked about T.I.'s son in the interview. So the next topic I want to talk about is a Harvard alumni. I think they said in 2023 that they said he donated upwards of $50 million to Harvard University. One moment, I'm going to pull the article up. And I'm only going to talk about it briefly. So he owns Citadel. CEO Ken Griffin owns Citadel. Oh, I said 50 million. He actually donated 500 million to Harvard. And the article doesn't really unpack a lot of information around why. It just says that he no longer has an interest in donating to Harvard. And so for those of you who haven't followed, the Harvard just had their first African-American, it's probably their first African-American president, period. She was also an African-American female. Some people are saying she got fired, but the way that they publicly allowed her to maintain to save face or allow her to maintain some dignity was that they published that she resigned. And so there was a lot of pressure around just a lot of different, what I feel like were petty topics. And things like she didn't have enough accoutrements around her scholastic ability. And then they said she wasn't responding to the war, the way that the Palestinian war, the way that she should have responded and dealing with the politics on the campus, right? But this is what I'm going to tell you as a writer. I haven't met anyone yet that does more writing than I do. Like, I literally write every day. And so while I may publish like a short article on social media, like I'm writing pages every day, like 3 or 4 pages every day, whether it's an article for the magazine or if it's a letter that I'm writing or drafting or an article that I'm submitting. And this is what I want to tell you is that most of my articles that are published are the articles that are published through the Making of the Mogul journal and magazine, which is why the purpose of why I created that platform. Because some people refer to me as a journalist, and I humbly have yet to refer to myself as that. And so I humbly add that title to my resume with all humbleness, right? Like that's an extreme honor to me, particularly considering that I was told that my writing was terrible, right? So I'm excited when I hear people refer to me as a journalist. But can I be honest? Like, for my brand, it is not palatable for people who don't really want to see America with a magnifying glass, right? Like, some people are still under the auspice that the America that we live in is equal for all people, particularly Black people. And we're no longer, Black people are no longer the minority. I don't know, a lot of people still refer to Black people as a minority because it's political. It allows us to be able to still maintain some of the help that we receive because we're not equal economically, right? But we are not any longer the minority on this planet. And in the United States, right? If we go back to the rules of how do we classify African-American people, right? And so I can name journals, companies that I've, or publishers that I've sent articles into, and they haven't been published, right? But I have the type of brand that potentially people don't want to be associated with, because I'm a truth teller and I try to do it with the utmost discrepancy and couth. But sometimes people don't get it until you really have to let them see it in its totality, right? If you keep softening the topic and the subject matter, people still try to pretend like it's not a thing and still try to continue to ignore it. And I think it is the honesty of my writing can sometimes be too much for academic journals who want to still maintain control of the narrative of the United States. And so unless I write a fluffy article with a lens and a perspective that really doesn't belong to me, right? When I write an article in the perspective of this is what I what they want to hear and what they want to read. And most of those articles I withdrew because they begin to eat at my conscience. Because I want to maintain some authenticity for being able to finesse the truth without damaging people, but telling the truth in a way that it heals the people that need to be healed, right? And so when they talk about Claudine not being accomplished enough or have produced enough academic rhetoric or academic prowess or published academic work, most of my publishing has been privately published. And I've had to create platforms to publish myself because America's publishing doesn't want my form of art, which is my writing. And so there have been some people that, and I say it all the time, there are people who play at the highest level of the playing field who are not the way that you necessarily think that they are. And those are the people that are starting to pull their money from the philanthropic endeavors of Harvard. And I think it's probably going to be sobering for them, probably for the next few years, as some of these billionaires and multimillionaires pull their dollars back from Harvard because of the shame, right, that they brought to the university, as well as what they brought to Claudine by forcing her to resign. Particularly for the petty reasons that they decided to pick out. And so that is the difficulty with getting published as someone who publishes material through the lens and the perspective of the African-American experience. Let's talk about The Color Purple. And I need to put you on pause because I need to do something and I'll be right back. All right. Thank you so much. What were we talking about next? So The Color Purple. They keep saying that, I don't know why people think that The Color Purple didn't make any money. I don't know. The Color Purple brought in a lot of money within the first 2 weeks. I think they're trying to say that it could have brought in, it brought in like $60 million total. But like within the first, I want to say within the first week or two, that it had broken some records. And so I think it was, they were expecting it to do double numbers For example, like the Hidden Figure in totality, it brought in $236 million. The Help brought in $216 million. And it was, The Color Purple was around the same as The West Side Story. It actually brought in less than The West Side Story. Excuse me, The West Side Story actually brought in $76 million, and it's in total. The Color Purple brought in $60 million, and they're associating that with the toxicity of how Taraji was basically exposing how the actresses were treated. And then I think they tried to do some when the numbers weren't there the way that they were anticipating for the Color Purple. I think they tried to do some damage control. And then they did an interview between Oprah and Taraji to just like squash any rumors of beef or that they were beefing or anything like that. But by that time it had already tainted the publicity of the rollout. And so they were somewhat stating that Taraji had suppressed the rollout of The Color Purple because of everything that she was stating, like they didn't have transportation to and from the venue for filming. Just little incidentals that are really important to an artist, whether you're an actress or whatever it is that you do. There are some things that are very, very important to you being able to survive day to day. And if someone is inviting you or hosting you, they're incidentals that are supposed to be taken care of by the company, right? Or the organization. And so Taraji was basically saying they didn't get any of that. And then she also felt like they were, for as large of a film as it was, she felt like that they were underpaid, particularly that she was underpaid, based on the fact that she was an accomplished actress, right? With nominations as well as awards. And so instead of the $60 million, it's basically saying that Color Purple should have made somewhere in the upwards of $200 million. But then film enthusiasts were basically saying that within the culture that we don't do well with remakes, that typically remakes don't do that well within the culture. And I haven't looked at any data, and I don't have anything to compare that to. So I don't know if that's true, or if it's not true, or if it was just that Taraji was discontented and just overshadowed the rollout of the movie. I don't know. Now, here is the thing. If they truly felt like that, then that's a scary situation for Taraji, because she was paid for the film, and technically they have the right to go back and recover damages if they feel like she damaged the rollout of the movie. So I hope that, I feel like that's what they're trying to set the stage for. And I hope not, because this will probably be the first time in history, right, that we would probably see something like that in African-American cinematography. And so I could say some other things about it, but I'm not, that's not what I want to be on today. But in that in that same vein, let's talk about, and this is something that I talk about often in lectures, is social responsibility. So corporations, businesses, they have a corporate responsibility. And then us as artists, me as a writer and a publisher, and an entry-level producer, I have a responsibility to my audience. And while I understand, and this is a difficult conversation to have, because as African Americans, when we look at all ethnicities of people, it is the toughest for African Americans, because people always feel like we have to carry the responsibility of the entire culture. And I'm totally against that. Like, I don't think we owe anybody anything for making it, right? And there are parts of, there are people like within the African American culture that feel like once you make it, and if you're African American, that you have a weighted responsibility to the African American community in ways that I think is unhealthy. The weight that they put on people individually, and it's not always balanced. Like, we put more weight on certain people because of this or because of that than we do other people. And I think that as the public, people from within the culture that are not in the realm of producers, as in producing work, whether it's writing, acting, producing, sound, stage production, if you're not on that side of it, I don't think people understand the balance between what it means to try and balance that within your own life, right? Like, I don't think it's fair. Had I made it as an actress, I don't think that it would have been fair if somebody was to come back to me and say, oh, you decided to be an actress, so you knew everything that comes along with being an actress. Well, actually, no, you don't. You don't know what comes along with being a wife. You don't know what comes along with being a public figure. You don't know what comes along with being an entrepreneur. You don't know what comes along with just the basic responsibility, the other things, that the blind spots, the things that people don't really talk about, that is also associated when you decide to develop a platform or to develop your artistry. And I don't think people understand that as artists, when we're not performing, or when we're not on stage, or when we don't have the ability to write and publish and to be recognized for the work that we do, it affects us in ways that a person that's not really what they are called to do, it's not the same impact. Right? Because when I write an article, I write it from my soul, right? It's from my experience, the encompassing of my experiences and how I see the world and the lens and the perspective of how I process things. That's why it's personal to us when we see people mimic and mirror those experiences without them having to work through the difficulty of what those experiences produced in our lives as residue, right? So it's offensive for me to have written an article and it's coming from my soul because of an experience that I've had in an organization. And then I see somebody on their platform who is obviously regurgitating the exact same information, but they don't reference it because they feel like information is there for the taking. And it doesn't matter, right? That I'm a published author. It doesn't matter that I'm an educator. And that most of the material that I put out there is protected through publishing rights, right? So they ain't even considering that I can go back and sue them. And I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about any artist, right? And so we don't necessarily know all the things that go with that. And there's, and it's unfair to say to an artist, well, you picked that profession and so you knew what was going to go with it. Well, if I chose to suppress this part of myself, there would be parts of me that I couldn't live with. Because in order for me to be in the entire who I am, that part of me has to be shared with the world, right? And for some people, like when I was married, my way of communicating that artistic part of me was within my marriage and within my family, like through culinary experiences and planning family events and things of that nature, right? So I don't agree with the weight, the impact of the weight that we place on artists, but this is what I do agree with, is that we all have some measure of responsibility for what agendas and politics we're willing to participate in, right? And so you cannot pretend like you're blinded to the politics when you either participate in the agendas and the politics or you pass them up. And I think the difference between Taraji and Vivica, and we could say Vivica doesn't have children, and but Taraji does have children. Right. We could boil it down to that. I don't know. Right. I'm not placing judgment on Taraji. But what I'm saying is that Vivica has been able to sustain her career and to still be relevant to Black cinema. And she somehow avoided the toxicity of all of the agendas and the politics. And so a lot of people tried to be tough on Vivica when she spoke up and she said, I can't relate to Taraji's experiences. Like I can't relate to, she said, I'm excited that she shared that because it seemed like it was healing for people, for other Black women, right? That are actresses and that, work in entertainment. She said, but I can't relate to her experience. And I totally knew what she was talking about because those of us that avoid agenda politics, we have a different experience in life, right? Like the doors that are available to us are the doors that we take. Like we don't even think about the doors that have agenda politics written all over it because it just doesn't fit our lifestyle, our brand, and the image that we want to project into the world, right? So it's not even an option. So the experience is different from us. And I think what Taraji is running into is that she didn't opt out of all of the agenda politics when she was taking on various roles. It was just money for her. And I think she admitted that. And I think we need to provide her with the grace because she did admit that. She said, I now realize more than ever that when I'm on a stage or when I'm playing these roles that somebody is imagining or seeing themselves in these roles and it has an impact on their lives, right? She said that. I can't remember what stage she was on or what interview she was doing. And so I don't think up until now that she was totally conscious of it, but now that she's conscious of it, and now that the culture is kind of pushing back on artists that have been participating in these agenda politics that has been unhealthy for, particularly for the Black community and the upbringing of the next generation of leadership and helping them to understand to lean into healthy perspectives and healthy personification of the culture and the community, I think it's had an impact on her that that has been, that she feels is catastrophic, right? And I think what she feels now is that she risked her brand playing some of these roles, and it didn't really get her where she thought it was going to get her. And that's why she feels like she's back at ground zero. But that's because once you play them agenda politics, it taints your brand, where some people may or may not want to promote what's associated with your brand, right? And I think she's feeling the impact of that now. Why this late in her career? I really don't know. I don't know. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, because a lot of the roles that we used to, well, and now she feels like she's being blackballed. And as I'm looking at different things, different projects that Tyler Perry is rolling out, I noticed that she's not in them. And now she's went back to where she started at, which is where we often seen those more healthier roles from Taraji. And I hope she has the ability to bounce back for it. I hope that we provide her with the same grace that we would provide anybody else. But I hope for the next generation of artistry, actors, actresses, rappers, singers, that they can look at Taraji as an example and see the impact of what happens when they participate in agenda politics and it finally catches up with them. And I think that that is the difference between Taraji and Vivica. And I think, like, Vivica has one of the most sanitized brands out there as far as an actress, right? We don't see no mess around Vivica. We don't see no mess around her. And it's because she avoided the agenda politics and she kept her relationships private. Now, there was a little bit of fuss about her and 50 for a minute there. But for the most part, like, her acting career has been sustainable and sanitized, meaning we don't see no mud on her and her professional career. All right. So last but not least, the final topic that I want to talk about today is that I don't know if you all are aware, I decided to attach a lecture to Outliers, the lived research study of Curtis 50 Cent Jackson, media mogul Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. And the topic or the subject matter of the lecture is safeguarding your business and your income from the civil unrest from the election. And so if you follow politics, if you've been reading some of the major publications, CNN, and some of the other media news sources, that there are regions and municipalities that are preparing for civil unrest from the election. And so I remember being involved in something during the real estate crash was definitely a result of some of the civil unrest, right? From some of the politics, the shifting in the politics as it was who was in office, who was shifting out of office, who was handling the management of the finances for the United States. And there are ways that you can safeguard your career, your business, and your how you produce income for your household, how you safeguard those from the civil unrest that may shift some things after the election. And so the literary work is only $25. Once you order it and it's shipped, you'll have the instructions on the inside of how to access that lecture. And I highly encourage it. It is very relevant to this time period. And you'll be able to take the information. It's very tangible. It offers key takeaways where you'll be able to utilize it to safeguard your income and your business from not just civil unrest from presidential elections, but from various political impacts that the ebbs and flows that we see in politics. So this is behavioral scientist Tanola Oliver. I needed to do that brain dump because I got some writing to do. So I thought I would jump on here and talk with you all. It's always an honor and a privilege to have an audience that that trusts you and believes in the work that you do. And so this is behavioral scientist Tanola Oliver. This is the Making of the Mogul radio show, where the dream is free, but the hustle is sold separately. Signing off until we talk again. Peace.